Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk. And maybe, after all of that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way, thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all of your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something is coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel, or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Epochs!
Hello and welcome back to Epochs. This shall be the last episode on Henry V. After this one, I'll move on to something else entirely. So if you remember last time, we ended up with the murder of the John the Fearless, Duke of Burgundy, and Henry entering Paris in triumph, essentially. So I'll pick up the story with Anne Curry and with quite a bit of detail on the last few years, last couple of years odd of Henry's life. So, Anne Curry tells us this. In the cathedral at Troyes on the 21st of May, 1420, Henry V was acknowledged by Charles VI, King of France, as heir to the French crown. So, you know, effectively disinheriting the Dauphin, his own son, who's got a giant faction and lots of money and influence. So it's all very well, Henry winning a battle and forcing his opponent's hand politically, but the Dauphin and all his supporters are still out there, so they haven't just disappeared. In the opening passage of the treaty, sealed on that day, Charles noted how several previous treaties had been made between his predecessors and those of the most high prince of our very dear son, Henry, King of England and heir of France, but none had brought the fruit of peace so desired. Mindful of how much damage and sorrow has been caused by the division of the kingdoms to this point, not only for the kingdoms, but also for the church, Charles was now making peace with Henry, even if in reality it had been Henry who had called the tune in the preceding negotiations. The 31 main clauses which follow give the terms of this peace. Henry was not to hinder Charles's possession of the French crown while he lived, but at his death the crown of France was to remain perpetually with Henry and his heirs. From that point on, the two crowns were always to be held by the same person, even though the two kingdoms would retain their liberties, customs, usages, and laws. It was not the Treaty of Troyes which made Henry heir to France. He was already that by virtue of the long-standing claim of the English kings to the French crown. Remember, that was the whole reason he went to France and had a war in 1415 in the first place, because he was claiming to be King of France from way back when, from hundreds of years before, at least through the female line. Curry continues, the crucial importance of Troyes was that a French king was now on record as having formally acknowledged that claim. What was more, while retaining his crown, Charles effectively passed his rule immediately to Henry. Quote, because we are hindered in such a way, his madness, that is, that we cannot personally attend to the disposition of the business of our realm, the faculty and exercise of governing and ordering, everything concerning the good of the kingdom and its people. So it shall be invested in our son, Henry. Curry again. Over the next few weeks, we see Henry dropping his title of King of France and replacing it with heir and regent of France. To understand such an amazing and unexpected settlement, we need to return to the events of the previous autumn, the murder of John the Fearless by the Dauphin's supporters at the Bridge of Montreux on the 10th of September 1419. It removed all hope of French unity and forced the Burgundians to ally with Henry. At this point, the French king and queen remained at Troyes where they had been placed by Duke John in order to keep them under his control. The new Duke of Burgundy, John's son Philip, was in Lille, while most of the royal council was still under the control of Burgundian officials in Paris. So the French are sort of completely divided and kind of in the middle of some sort of civil war still. The citizens of Paris, always a pro-Burgundian and powerful lobby, were alarmed that the murder might embolden Henry to make an attack on the capital. On the 19th of September 1419, the royal council, with the support of Paris, approached Henry for a truce and to discuss revenge for the murder. Henry's response, 5 days later, was to empower his ambassadors to negotiate a final peace. 3 days later, they made a declaration to the royal council which emphasised Henry's right to the French throne, but, in wording presumably intended to reassure the French, stated that he had no intention that, quote, his French crown, kingdom or people should be subject to his English crown, or that the people of France should become or be called English, end quote. Once again, he proposed marriage to Catherine, and although the declaration did not explicitly mention that Charles would remain king for the rest of his life, it promised that Henry would treat his prospective royal in-laws with the honour they deserved. So Henry bargaining for the full shebang at that point. Henry was undoubtedly the originator of the terms later enshrined in the Treaty of Troyes. He realised that it was to his advantage to stake his claim before the French government and the new Duke of Burgundy had time to develop their own response to the murder of Duke John. When the council at Paris responded by saying the declaration was not what Henry had been asking for in July, the king replied bluntly, "Things are different now." Over the following week, he developed his plans further, proposing Charles remain king until death. In a flurry of diplomatic activity with Paris, Lille and Troyes, the full terms of a final peace were negotiated. Duke Philip, the new young Duke of Burgundy, gave his agreement on the 2nd of December. For him, revenge against the Dauphin, hitherto the unquestioned Valois heir to the crown of France, for his father's murder was paramount. His adherence to Henry's terms brought the promise of English military support. Meanwhile, Henry ordered a closer watch to be kept on Charles, Duke of Orléans, who had been prisoner in England since his capture at Agincourt. After all, what Henry was proposing was effectively the disinheritance of the whole of the Valois dynasty, and the Duke was the next male heir after the Dauphin. Henry had Louis Robesart, a close associate since 1403, sent to Troyes to help persuade Charles and his wife, Queen Isabeau, to accept English terms. With Duke Philip joining the King and Queen at Troyes on the 23rd of March, the full treaty was agreed on the 9th of April 1420 between the English, headed by the Earl of Warwick, and the French. Henry moved from Pontoise on the 8th of May to the Abbey of St. Denis, the necropolis of French kings, where he paid his obligations as heir before arriving at Troyes. On the same day, the treaty was sealed. Henry and Catherine were betrothed. They were married less than 2 weeks later, on the 2nd of June. The treaty was announced immediately in France and its terms sent back to England to be proclaimed so that, quote, all our people may have very true knowledge thereof of their consolation. Negotiations had added many clauses to the basic terms in order to serve the various parties involved. For instance, although Henry promised that any further conquests he made be for the benefit of the French crown, he kept Normandy under his personal control until he became king, at which point it would be reintegrated into France. He realised that he could not draw back immediately from his encouragement of the Norman separatism, which had facilitated his conquest. But the Burgundians were to have restoration of lands he had taken from their supporters in the duchy. Charles and Isabeau were reassured that they would only have French servants. Catherine's dowry was to be paid from English revenues. Henry's keenness led him to dispense with a requirement for a French dowry until he died, at which point his widow was henceforward to have 20,000 francs per annum. The Burgundian desire for revenge against the Dauphin was guaranteed by a ban on any party included in the treaty negotiating with Charles, who calls himself Dauphin, and by a commitment on Henry to labour with all his might, and as soon as can profitably be done, to put into our obedience all the places and persons within our realm disobedient to us, and rebels of the party commonly called that of the Dauphin of Armagnac. Henry's idea of allowing Charles VI to remain king may have come to his mind much earlier in the reign, when after the fall of Harfleur in 1415, he summoned the Dauphin, Louis, to personal combat. Henry proposed that the victor should succeed Charles at his death. Yet it is hard to believe that Henry ever dreamed that the prospect of his being accepted as Charles's heir would become a reality. He drove a hard bargain in 1420, but was astute enough to know that much more was to be gained by negotiations than by conquest. Only through formal recognition by a king of France did a king of England have any chance of his claim to the French crown being recognised and implemented. Meanwhile, the people of France were to take an oath to observe the treaty with allegiance to Henry, and the wording of that stated, as governor and regent of the kingdom of France, to obey him in all matters concerning the government, which is subject to the king of France, and after the death of Charles, to continue as liegemen and true subjects of King Henry of England and his heirs for ever, to accept and obey the same as sovereign lord and true king of France without opposition, contradiction, or difficulty, coming to his aid as soon as requested, Curry continues. As regent and heir, Henry had access to all the resources of the French kingdom, and all that he did was in the name of Charles VI. So, Henry, even though our Henry, Henry V, even though he's not actually full king of France, he's just regent, he is effectively, in essence, the king in all but name. He is in control of the government. He is absolutely in control in real terms of nearly all, if not all, of northern France. And he controls the purse strings. So he's got all the cards. He's got all the power, really. You don't necessarily have to be crowned. I mean, it's nice. And he would have hoped to have formally been crowned as soon as Charles died. But to all intents and purposes, he's in the cockpit of power thoroughly. And Curry goes on. A couple of days after his wedding, accompanied by Charles VI, Catherine and Philip of Burgundy, Henry went to besiege the Burgundian city of Sens, then under the control of the Dauphin. This was an essential step towards recovering the town of Montreux, which Henry did in short order on the 1st of July, and with it the body of Duke John for burial in the Burgundian capital of Dijon. The siege of Melun followed. On the Seine, near Paris, this town had held out against Henry. According to the chronicler Enguerrand de Monstrelet, the inhabitants' refusal to surrender led Henry to bring Charles VI to receive their surrender as their natural lord. The Treaty of Troyes had not ended war. Rather, war had mutated, becoming a rather different conflict in which Henry and his troops, in the name of the French king, collaborated with the Burgundians in their conflict with the Armagnacs. Inevitably, not all Frenchmen accepted the Treaty of Troyes. Although the Dauphin had fled south, his supporters were prepared to fight for his interests. Melun did not surrender to Henry until the 1st of November. Only then was it possible for Charles and Henry to make a ceremonial entry into Paris on the 1st of December. The choice of Advent Sunday was deliberate, and the delay also allowed ample time for the streets to be decorated and the population to be clad in red to symbolise their rejoicing. You can only imagine a lot of Parisians were doing so through gritted teeth. Although they were pro-Burgundian, so they may well have preferred this to the Dauphin, but you can imagine quite a lot of them wouldn't. Like all of France, Paris is split politically. The event was orchestrated to provide a visual representation of the treaty terms. The king entered the city side by side with Charles on the right as the anointed king of France. When relics were presented for the king to kiss, Charles motioned for Henry to go first, but the latter touched his cap and gestured that Charles should precede him. The kings then entered Notre Dame side by side, paying their devotion at the high altar. On the following day, the two queens, Catherine and Isabeau, entered Paris and were greeted by English lords and Duke Philip of Burgundy. The fact that they entered later and after their royal husbands reflected not only the lower status of queens, but also the careful handling by Henry to avoid any suggestion that France had come to him through his marriage. Henry was already heir when he married, or at least in his mind. Indeed, part of the reason that Catherine's dowry was to be paid from English revenues was to remove any notion that she brought France with her as her dowry to her husband. The marriage, although mentioned in the Treaty of Troyes, was given naturally and simply there as being for the benefit of peace. Later, back in England, this was emphasised at the banquet on the 24th of February 1421, following Catherine's coronation in Westminster Abbey as Queen of England, which Henry did not attend. The treaty did not require the kings of the double monarchy to be Henry's heirs by Catherine, or even the heirs of his body, but simply his heirs general. So it could be his brothers if he died without a child, or even one of his cousins or something. That was why, immediately behind him on the entry into Paris, walked the two eldest of his brothers, Thomas and John, the Duke of Clarence and Bedford. Henry had ensured that all elements of his rights and of the future of the English-held double monarchy had been covered. The Treaty of Troyes had already effectively disinherited the Dauphin by not recognising him in his title, since to do so was to undermine Henry's own claim to the French throne. His formal disinheritance came on the 23rd of December 1420 by a lit de justice, a formal session in the Parlement of Paris, France's principal law court, following French legal form. Meanwhile, shortly after the entry into Paris, Duke Philip and a representative of his mother made formal complaint against the Dauphin for his role in the murder of Duke John. His petition was held by Charles VI and Henry sitting side by side on the same bench, with the preservation of French institutions as stipulated in the Treaty of Troyes, symbolised by the Chancellor of France and the first President of the Parlement sitting at Charles's feet. The King, Charles VI, through his Chancellor, promised that with the advice of Henry, King of England, Regent and Heir of France, justice would be done. The Dauphin was duly found guilty and declared disinherited and an outlaw. Oof. Although Henry's time as Regent of France was being dominated by military activity, his influence on French government was substantial, as might be expected from a monarch who took his responsibilities seriously, and in a situation where Charles VI continued to suffer from absences, i.e. absences of sanity, as royal documents called the periods when his mental state deteriorated, which made his active involvement in government inconsistent and minimal. Henry even issued some royal letters in his own name as heir, although the majority were in the name of Charles VI, quote, by the advice and deliberation of our beloved heir and regent, the King of England, quote. When in Paris, Henry held the councils in person, as he did on the 3rd of June 1422, and we find him consulted by the Parlement and other bodies. He was also responsible for making appointments, always being careful, save for the higher military commands in Paris, to which he appointed his brother Thomas, and subsequently the Duke of Exeter, to use Frenchmen of the Burgundian persuasion. His influence in ecclesiastical appointments was as influential as in England. In December 1420, the chapter of Notre Dame elected Jean Cortecuse as Bishop of Paris, a choice opposed by both Henry and Duke Philip. Although the appointment was confirmed by the Pope, Henry remained recalcitrant and his influence was decisive. Cortecuse was eventually appointed by the Pope on the 12th of June 1422 to the bishopric of Geneva instead. So that shows, doesn't it? That's important. That's an interesting data point. That shows that the will of Henry V now is enough to sort of overrule the Pope. Henry V is, at this stage, the most powerful man in northwestern Europe, perhaps all of Western Europe. He's absolutely one of the most powerful people in the known world, among the most powerful people in the known world. You know, the Holy Roman Emperor Sigismund and the Pope are sort of not really as powerful as him.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. Yet you still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is, managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all of your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money you wasted. Plus, you can use the smart savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved them more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play stores.